Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The media giant Comcast is in the news for several reasons this week, and commentator David Sirota from the International Business Times is all over their case. We'll talk to David in just a minute. First, have you heard this 8-minute piece of audio that has gone viral online of a Comcast customer trying to cancel his internet service? Apparently, the company has what they call retention specialists. Did you know this job exists? Retention specialists whose job it is to talk people out of canceling their service. They reportedly get paid more for keeping more people in the fold. So here's about a 1-minute excerpt of how it went when Ryan Block, a vice president at AOL, as it happens, tried to cancel his Comcast internet without stating a reason.
I am declining to state why we are leaving Comcast because I don't owe you an explanation. So if you can please just go proceed to the next question. If you have to fill out your form, that's fine. Please proceed to the next question, and we'll attempt to answer that if possible.
Okay. So, I mean, being that we are the number one provider of internet and TV service in the entire country, okay, why is it that you're not wanting to have the number one rated internet service, number one rated TV service available?
I'm declining to state we're switching providers. Can you please go to the next question?
Okay. So what is it about us towns that's making you want to change to them?
I'm declining to state. Can you please go to the next question so we can cancel our service?
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out here what it is about Comcast service that you're not liking, that you're not wanting to keep. I mean, why is it that you don't want to keep that service?
This phone call is a really actually amazing representative example of why I don't want to stay with Comcast. So can you please cancel our service?
All right. A little of the customer service call from hell for one Ryan Block trying to cancel his Comcast internet service. That has been listened to more than 5 million times on SoundCloud. The company has said it will revisit its training of retention specialists, which suggests, as PC World pointed out in an article this week, that haranguing the customer for 8 minutes before agreeing to disconnect may have been what they've been training their people to do. So now let's talk to David Sirota, International Business Times columnist who has Comcast in his sights for other reasons and says New York could have a lot to say about whether the proposed Comcast-Time Warner merger is approved, creating a cable and internet service behemoth with the one company controlling about a third of all cable and what they call fixed high-speed internet markets. David Sirota is based in Denver, but is in New York today. Hi, David. Welcome to WNYC Studios.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your column this week is actually about a case in Tennessee where a community-owned internet service provider that's doing well wants to compete with the big boys. But have you gawked with your ears at this piece of customer service audio along with the rest of us?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in another part of the audio, they actually make the argument, they say, Comcast does, that they have the fastest internet in the country, which is actually not true, as we'll discuss.
And it was interesting that Comcast Damage Control included saying, despite the call being painful to listen to, the retention specialist did a lot of what they trained him to do, and they would review their training programs. But do we conclude at least then that this is not unique to Comcast, but is corporate customer relations in general with retention specialists and high-pressure techniques?
I would agree with that. I think that this is a commentary on a situation where you arguably have two people who are victims. You have the customer who's a victim, and you most likely have the customer service representative who is being told that they will be punished if they don't do certain things, in this case, retain the customer or at least get a reason for why the customer is leaving.
So lifts a veil on that. Now that one little piece of audio popped out and became an internet sensation. And you wrote to us that New York has the power to block the proposed merger between Comcast and Time Warner. Tell us about this merger proposal and why you're skeptical of it.
Well, the merger proposal, as you said, would create one company that controls about a third of all internet and cable conduits in the country. That is a arguably unprecedented amount of media power, that is, power to control the conduits from which you get your information. New York State has the power under its Public Utility Commission, Public Service Commission, to block or potentially put an obstacle to the merger. A number of states where Time Warner exists have these commissions that have the authority under their state law to stop or at least slow down these mergers. It's not clear whether New York State is going to do that, although there has been some words from Governor Cuomo in which he said he's not going to get in the way of this, the commission looking at this.
For a sense of how big Comcast is getting, they also own NBC, mm-hmm. NBC Universal, and all their content. And here's a piece on The Street. Some people know that site, the Wall Street and Business Affairs website, The Street, posted yesterday, headlined, "Comcast is now the center which the world revolves around." Huh. And it says Comcast is now assuming the big bad boy role that was once held by Microsoft and then Google and now also by Amazon. But at that size and that level of questionable ethics in throwing their weight around. So, for example, The Street calls Comcast the lightning rod for net neutrality activists. Why Comcast of all the internet service providers on this net neutrality issue of, you know, not having pay for the same speed access for all websites?
I think the big part of it, to your question, is what you referred to earlier, which is Comcast ownership of content and the tubes. That's a key point here, that it typically had been that the people who owned the so-called tubes, those conduits, the broadband lines, those were different companies than the ones that actually produced the content. Comcast, in owning, for instance, NBC, now owns two pieces of the distribution system, what is actually being produced, and then the lines to send it to your home, into your home. And so the net neutrality piece, I think the fear is that the company will use its ownership of the conduit to preference its own content that it's producing and then make it more difficult, if not impossible, or certainly expensive to get competitors' content. So ABC, CBS, et cetera, et cetera.
And this would be a national merger with Time Warner. How could New York block it?
Well, again, New York is a Time Warner state, and the states in which that are Time Warner states, California as well, have public service or public utilities commissions in which they are allowed to weigh in depending on state laws. In New York, there's been discussion about whether to change the state law from saying that a merger essentially can't be blocked if it can't be proven to be in the public interest, to the burden being on the merger companies themselves, that they have to prove that this is in the public's interest. And the question is, though, is whether the commission will use its discretion to even make a ruling, to even and arguably extract concessions. Right? New York can actually say to Comcast, right, in order for us to let this go through, you're going to have to agree to certain concessions, whether that's rate concessions or the like.
And Rupert Murdoch is also pursuing Time Warner. Fox has a competing big offer on the table. Is either the lesser of two evils, in your opinion?
Well, I think the answer is yes. I guess you could put it that way. And I say that because let's remember that this is not a competitive situation. The two things that are happening right now, you have mergers in which fewer and fewer companies control the conduits. And then you also have efforts to restrict local competition to those large behemoths. As you mentioned, and we can discuss the Chattanooga situation, it's a community-owned broadband service that's got the fastest service in the country. That Chattanooga service is from a public utility. It wants to expand. And Tennessee has a state law that says that that company, that utility, cannot expand. That law was passed at the behest of giant telecom companies. And Congress is now weighing in to tell the FCC, do not use your power to preempt those state laws. In other words, do not use your power to allow local competitors to Comcast.
Listeners, we have big oil, we have big agriculture, we have big internet in America as an industry at this point, and a few companies perhaps, or one, about to get much bigger. Call in and talk to International Business Times columnist David Sirota if you want, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And tell us about the Tennessee case you wrote about this week, obviously with national implications, involving a community-owned internet service provider trying to fight the big boys.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of public or quasi-public utility companies across the country. Chattanooga has one of them. Many of those utility companies are developing smart grid technology. That is to use high-speed fiber optic cable to communicate with all of the energy distribution systems in their jurisdiction. What Chattanooga discovered was that, hey, we already have this infrastructure. We're building out this infrastructure for our electricity needs and the community's electricity needs. This can also be a conduit for high-speed internet service, broadband service, into our customers' homes. And we can provide it at a market competitive price. And so what happened a few years ago was the Chattanooga utility opened up its service to the community and now provides the fastest internet service in the country, some of the fastest internet service in the world, for roughly $70 a month. And this has been a boon to the tech industry in Chattanooga, to the small business community in Chattanooga, obviously to customers in Chattanooga. And now Chattanooga, which is in a state where 1 in 5 people do not have access to the internet at all, it wants to expand the service, and in particular to areas that have been underserved in Tennessee. And what's happened is that previous to all of this, Tennessee passed a law saying that municipal broadband companies, publicly owned utilities, cannot expand beyond their jurisdiction. So the Chattanooga utility can't go outside of Chattanooga. This is one of 20 laws like this in the entire country that were passed by the big telecom companies to restrict municipal taxpayer-owned broadband, because the big telecom companies, for obvious reasons, don't want to have to compete with anybody, much less a taxpayer-owned, not-for-profit kind of system.
Let's talk about this as taxpayer-owned. You use the terms community-owned internet service provider with respect to that group interchangeably with publicly owned and municipal. Are we talking about government-provided internet service competing with companies that do the same thing?
In Chattanooga's case, yes. The terms, you're right, they're fluid. Some of the utilities are almost co-ops where they're customer-owned. In Chattanooga, it is a utility in which the city, the actual city itself, the municipal government, which is, you know, a.k.a. the taxpayers, own the utility that runs the internet service. And the thing is that the old narrative is that government, when it owns something, is inefficient, does things poorly, is slow. I mean, when you think about government-owned internet service, I think a lot of people probably think, well, it's probably going to be really slow. Again, it is the fastest internet service in the world. And part of the reason, at least the proponents of this say, is because it can take the revenues that it makes and put it directly back into building out the network rather than paying it out in terms of shareholder dividends or executive salaries.
So here's the policy issue. The congresswoman there, Marsha Blackburn, a conservative lightning rod, wants Congress to pass a law that would block the FCC from overruling states that want to block community-owned internet providers from expanding. Now, that's a lot of people blocking people from blocking people from blocking things. So can you unpack that for us?
Sure. I look at it this way. The FCC has the power to say to local communities and local utilities, you can expand where you want, right? The Tennessee law was actually an anti-local control bill, just like it is in 20 states, saying to cities inside the state, you may not or we may restrict you from expanding your publicly owned internet service. We're going to take away your local authority to have a publicly owned internet service. So the FCC retains the right to say to those states, that kind of state law against local municipal control, we can overrule in the name of expanding internet service. And Marsha Blackburn, who is from Tennessee, who's taken a lot of money from the big telecom companies, is now passed an amendment, at least in the House, to defund the FCC, specifically the FCC's authority to overrule that state law. It's a big win, at least for now, for the telecom companies.
Let's take some phone calls. Steve in Hillsdale, NJ. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
All right.
So I just wanted to comment. It goes back to partly the little fun 8-minute clip that you can hear on SoundCloud. He said that Comcast provides the fastest internet or something along those lines, and I laughed out loud. The problem with Comcast, when I moved here, I used to live in California, and I moved to New Jersey. Both times, I would only available to me one internet service provider. And in California, it was Time Warner Cable, and here in New Jersey, it's Comcast. I couldn't switch if I wanted to. And I know that there are faster internet available. Google Fiber isn't available for me, and I know that's faster. It's just incredibly frustrating to think that they could have even more control.
This speaks to the dual phenomena that are happening now. You have a merger creating a bigger Comcast. At the same time, you have Congress using its power to prevent local municipal competitors to Comcast. Those are two things happening at the same time.
Melanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Brian. I love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm trying to find good internet service. I don't really watch television, and so I was watching really closely the case following the Avino, I think it was called, Barry Diller's, the internet free, practically free, that people could get television. So shopping around, I realized that there's no way. Everyone I talk to, they're paying like $150 a month for basic internet and phone and television. I mean, you can't get, it's like a price fixing, and it just seems to me that there's some sort of collusion among these companies to keep us fixed to cable. And I just don't understand why the public TVs like PBS, ABC, NBC, and CBS don't come together, Fox, you know, the free ones, and just offer that kind of internet thing that would be absolutely free, because it would just, people can't afford it. They just can't afford this kind of money.
Melanie, thank you. And I think you raised one of the really central issues here, monopoly or quasi-monopoly, and an unusual solution, which is that the big networks band together to give people free internet to get their programs.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this gets to the fundamental question of what is deemed a public utility and what isn't. And we go back to the era of the railroads, in which there was this idea of a common carrier. Common carrier is now an FCC term, which deals with whether something is so central to commerce in the country that it becomes a heavily regulated utility, which gives the government all sorts of powers to make sure that there's equal access. This is part of the net neutrality debate. And I think we're finally getting to a situation 10 years, 15 years into the debate over internet policy about whether the internet is a utility, if not a full-on human right in the 21st century. And I think those are the kinds of questions that all of this is raising.
I once asked Google CEO Eric Schmidt at an event in front of an audience whether Google, because of its power, should be regulated as a public utility, because it's, you know, search function is so ubiquitous that should they then be regulated with respect to how they can use that to advertise and collect data and things like that? And the audience laughed. Now, that was about 5 years ago. Maybe things have progressed to the idea where that question wouldn't be considered laughable.
Well, do you know what audience isn't laughing about? That is Europe. Europe, in passing the laws to essentially compel Google to erase certain things in the past, this so-called right to forget, which I think is highly controversial in the sense of, are there censorship issues about forcing a company to delete information that's actually public information? But setting aside all that, Europe, I think, has taken the attitude, or is taking the attitude, that Google is more of a public utility because it is so dominant. And I think that's the fundamental question here. It used to be that you had a choice. Either companies were so big and had so much market share that they were broken up with antitrust laws, or they were regulated as a utility.
Uh-huh.
The question we're facing now is whether we want to allow those behemoths to simply exist without doing either thing.
Right. And I was just going to bring up that exact point and ask which is your preference. Would you rather see Time Warner and Comcast merge and, you know, have so much of the internet service market and then be regulated as a public utility and some of the other really big players in that market, or see the government act more like trust busters, try to encourage things like this community-owned provider in Tennessee that you wrote about, and try to break it all up?
I would say the latter. I think there is clearly a model there. There's 100-plus cities that have managed to eke out municipal broadband services, and there's plenty of opportunity for more of that. It's a very straightforward path for the government to use its antitrust powers and authorities in the FCC to simply say, we're going to create an environment in which those entities can compete, those nonprofit, community-owned, taxpayer-owned entities can compete with the behemoths. Let's at least see what happens when we have that. Right now, we're getting a situation, at least from Congress, in which the two companies are probably going to be allowed to merge into a behemoth, and Congress is also using its power to prevent local competitors.
Catherine in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. We've actually just been discussing this and trying to get Fios into our home, and we weren't shocked to see that it's still not here. We live in Brooklyn, and I wanted to find out if there are ways we could pressure companies to come into our neighborhood. Right now, we only have Time Warner Cable as an option, and it has just been a disaster. So are there ways citizens can work to try and pressure other companies to bring more competition? I know Fios was supposed to have come into 75% of the homes in New York City. That was the agreement, but from what I can see,
or at least
the availability
be available to that many homes to compete with the cable companies.
Yeah, the one answer is this, is that New York is not one of the states that has one of these laws on the books that prevents municipal Wi-Fi competition. So that's an important thing to know for your city council, your state legislators, et cetera, et cetera. The second point that I would make is that every so often Comcast or Time Warner or the combination of both has to go to a municipality for franchising rights. That is, they have a debate over all of the uses of the common areas underground, the pipes underground to lay the cable, et cetera, et cetera. It's called these franchising agreements. And the cities at those points in time, and I think it's once every 10 years or so, can extract concessions. One of the concessions that a city council potentially could say is you have to allow a competitor, or we're going to potentially offer a new franchise agreement with another competitor. So those are other access points to this politically.
And I guess as we wrap up here, that's another way to see the future, is that, is it really a monopoly? I mean, I know the cable companies are deathly afraid of Verizon Fios. And so maybe we are in an era of competition and not monopoly.
Well, I think there are sporadic examples of some competition. It is certainly not a functioning free market, to use that term. It is not a functioning competitive free market, especially when you have the government, Congress, potentially using its power to weigh in on behalf of one of the behemoths to prevent competition. And I think that as we move forward in all of this, if we can think about how do we actually create competition with a commodity that really is a public utility, and I think that's the key jump. We have to see the internet as a public utility, and then from there we can have the conversation about how to create a competitive market. Because if you don't see it that way, then you'll probably just say, "Well, look, it's a private market, a private business, and we'll just see what the market does."
The internet as public utility in the 21st century, and how to ensure that we have reasonable, affordable access. David Sirota, author and senior writer with the International Business Times. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
As most of America debates how to deport the unaccompanied children coming from Central America, New York City is setting up ways to help the ones here.
That we have to embrace all immigrants. We talked about the municipal ID card. We talked about legal services for people facing deportation, and trying to support these children who are now coming across the border because they're fleeing from violence.
Mayor de Blasio addressing the child migrant crisis from his Italy vacation. With us now, New York City Immigrant Affairs Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, who is leading a new task force on how to help those kids. Commissioner, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have an estimate of how many kids from which countries have come to New York City in, say, the last 2 years?
We have an estimate of the number of children who are among this sort of surge of unaccompanied minors, and it's estimated that around 3,300 or so have been placed in New York City already.
And how many of those roughly have chosen New York and come here directly themselves because they might have family or friends? And how many have been placed here, and I think you just used the term placed here, by the federal government?
Right. So most of these children that I was referring to have been placed here because they have family or relatives that are in the New York City area. They were likely somewhere else in a shelter, detention, and then were located in New York.
How are you most interested in helping these kids who are fleeing crime and drug violence in their countries?
What we've done is created an internal city task force, which has the Department of Education, the Administration for Child Services, and a number of other agencies involved to figure figure out how we can coordinate the services that we're already providing for the city and be able to do some targeted outreach to assist these particular children.
In what areas mostly?
In the areas of health and mental health screenings, legal screenings, as well as, you know, looking about to their educational placement, educational services.
So they're eligible to go to New York City public schools just by virtue of being here, right?
Absolutely.
And with regard to mental health, the Times had an article that referred to trauma as being a big need that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. I mean, these children are fleeing quite harrowing situations and then make a long journey from their home countries to ultimately land in New York City and in our school system. And I think we have a responsibility to ensure that their mental health needs are addressed as well.
And the Times reported that the federal government is asking for the city's help in finding shelters or other housing for the child migrants. Is there much homelessness in the city today among this population?
So the shelters that are in question actually would not be for homeless children so much as they would be for children who would be placed here temporarily before they're relocated to another part of the country where they may have a relative.
Is that a combination shelter and detention center in a way?
In a way.
Are you planning to help these kids win asylum or refugee status? I know you're a lawyer as well as immigration commissioner.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, access to justice for immigrants is a major goal of ours. And it's estimated that many of these children may have legitimate asylum claims or claims to other special visas for immigrant children. And so our hope would be to enable them to have legal screenings and get the assistance that they need from high-quality legal services providers.
Listeners, we can take your calls for the New York City Immigrant Affairs Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, 212-433-WNYC, on how to help the child migrants coming from Central America or anything else, 212-433-9692. And on due process and the applications for refugee status or asylum, an article in the Times the other day was about how so many of the kids won't really get due process as Washington makes it a priority to speed up deportations to discourage more people from coming. Do you see part of your job is to help individual kids resist the bum's rush?
Absolutely. I actually thought that Times article was excellent because it made the point that if you do expedited removal at the border, many of these children who may have asylum claims may not be able to make out those claims at the border for a variety of very compelling reasons. And so we really see our role as being able to connect these children to all of the services and supports they might have, which might be asylum, refugee status, etc.
What makes due process, in your opinion, for kids in this situation?
I think for kids in this situation, due process is actually being able to get qualified legal counsel that can help them assess their current sort of situation and their ability to make out a claim. And even if they have to be deported, have a counsel there to advise them and support them.
So will the city be providing lawyers to these kids?
So the city has actually already funded a program for deportation defense for New York City residents here, which is very exciting.
This is ongoing. This is prior to this particular wave.
It's prior to this particular wave. And then there are a number of different legal services providers who actually reached out to our office to say, how can we help support these children in particular? What can we do? Which would be pro bono counsel.
And I'm aware that City Council approved $5 million just last month for lawyers to help detained immigrants facing possible deportation. This fund is for something called the New York Immigrant Family Unit Project. Is some of that money for kids in this category?
The money is for anyone who finds themselves in immigrant detention here in New York City, but it's a good example of how we should provide counsel for all who are in these situations.
So what do you think the City of New York taxpayers are paying in total to help the wave of child migrants?
You know, at this point, we don't have an estimate of what the costs are because we're still figuring out how to connect the services that are potentially available to these children, but we should have a sense of that soon enough.
New York City Immigrant Affairs Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you have a comment or a question, what do you think when you hear statements like this from people like Senator John McCain?
There has to be a halt to this. That's what we want. And the best way to do that is for plane loads of these young people to be returning to the country of origin and their families who have spent as much as a year's salary paying these coyotes who are also in the business of $85 billion a year drug business will not be able to get their money and send their kids north.
Your reaction to any of that?
You know, my reaction to this whole situation is these are children and they're the victims here. And I hear things like that and I really see it as blaming the victim and that there are deeper root causes that we need to be addressing rather than shuttling these kids as fast as we possibly can back to situations of violence.
But to part of Senator McCain's clip there, what kinds of stories are you hearing from the kids about the coyotes or others who smuggle them here? We're hearing, you know, and maybe this is just coming from the immigration hawks who want to exaggerate the situation, I don't know, but we're hearing stories of kids being forced to act as drug runners, kids being abused, kids being forced into prostitution, their families being extorted, all this stuff.
When I hear that, I believe it to be true. I think it's part of the stories that we're hearing from these kids who are in New York City. And again, I think that's the reason that they're fleeing. They'd rather go to school. They'd rather be children and instead are facing these inescapable choices.
Except, yeah, inescapable choices. The John McCains of the world want to make it sound like the real danger to the kids is from the transport to the United States rather than from staying put.
Absolutely. And these children likely don't want to leave their original homes, but they don't. They're trapped in making this choice to have to basically risk life and limb to travel to another country.
So President Obama tried to look at the root causes the other day as part of the bulwark of American policy toward these kids in the long term. He said this.
The American people are an incredibly compassionate people. And when we see a child in need, we want to care for them. But what I think we all agreed on is that the best thing that we can do is to make sure that the children are able to live in their own countries safely.
So that's a statement of the ideal. He's not quite saying the same thing as John McCain said, but he's really not saying the same thing as you're saying either, which is that the immediate imperative is to help the kids who are here be safe and get due process. He's saying we have to create the conditions to get them back to their home countries as soon as possible. Are you getting the support at the city level that you want, either, you know, philosophically, ideologically, or logistically from Washington?
Well, you know, we've been, in terms of our interaction at the city level, we have a tremendous amount of support. And I think we're trying to get better information from the federal government about how many children they anticipate will be placed here and better coordination. And we wish we had probably a little bit more of that. But what we can do at the city level has been really fantastic.
Like what? More coordination, more of that. What do you want from Washington that you're not getting?
I think we would like clear data, for sure, on the number of children and a little bit clearer channels of communication about what to expect.
What to expect regarding?
Regarding the children and sort of where what the plans are in terms of the policy framework here is really evolving quite rapidly. And so being able to have a point of contact in understanding how this will affect New York City at the federal level will be very helpful.
Raymond in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with the New York City Immigration Affairs Commissioner. Hello, Raymond. Raymond, are you there? All right, we'll try to get back to Raymond. Why do you think the reaction to the influx of these unaccompanied kids is so much different in New York than almost anywhere else? Most of the country seems to see them as anything from a nuisance to a sovereignty threat. People here seem pretty chill about the whole thing. Texas Governor Rick Perry is deploying the Texas National Guard to the border to keep these kids out. We're deploying legal aid lawyers to help them stay in. Why the difference, do you think?
You know, well, one thing I'll say is I'm not really sure how much some of these more provocative examples like Rick Perry are really reflective of the vast majority of Americans. It's really hard to know. I think most people, President Obama was right, are compassionate, realize that these are children. And so, you know, I don't know how much they reflect most of America. But this is sort of the way New York City's always been with regard to immigrant communities. We see immigrants as an asset rather than a detriment to our city's well-being. And so I think that partly explains the different attitude.
Let's try Margaret in Washington Heights. Margaret, can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I am glad that we have resources and that we're deploying them to take care of the immediate problem. But I am very concerned about establishing a precedent for the long term. We have many, many serious problems in New York and in our own country. We don't even have much of a safety net for the people who are here. And I worry about the plight of these children in future if they stay. And I really don't believe that we have any right to interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries.
By domestic affairs of other countries, that would include not taking in refugees or people who see themselves as refugees fleeing those countries?
There are laws in place, and there is a process for bringing refugees into the United States, and that's been in place for quite a long time. I see that this is an emergency refugee situation, but as I say, I'm very concerned about establishing a precedent so that this becomes an ongoing problem, which, by the way, does not resolve the issues in the home countries where these children come from.
Is your bottom line concern that the United States or New York will be overrun by too many refugees in a way that will cripple or hamper our society, our ability to function as a society?
No, because I don't think the numbers have ever existed in quite that proportion. But I do see it as creating something of a problem for us in future.
Margaret, thank you very much.
Well, you know, one thing I would say, and I've thought about this a lot, is that it's not really an either-or situation. So one of the things we're doing in the city, right, is we expanded universal pre-K. We've expanded the number of slots for middle school, after-school programs. We're doing a lot for children in New York, and we're hoping to do a lot for these kids as well. And so I think the broad point is actually true, which is that we need to address these longer-term questions about the social safety net and how we ensure that all children have a healthy and productive future. And at least so far, in Mayor de Blasio's administration, we've been thinking about both sides of that problem.
Do you acknowledge that the number of kids making it across suggests the federal government is not in control of the border?
Well, that's an interesting thing, too, because most of these kids, the reason they're being identified is because they are being apprehended at the border, or they're often showing up and voluntarily turning themselves over to Border Patrol.
Because they see that as their means to safety.
Exactly. And so the notion that we need to actually further militarize the border is a little bit funny, because we are actually pretty secure at the border, and that's how these kids are being identified in the first place.
Let's try Raymond in the Bronx again. Raymond, do you have me now?
Yes,
hi.
I'm here.
Hi.
Well, my question is this. I mean, okay, let's say I take myself. I mean, I understand that, you know, we can allow a certain amount of refugees in because we should have compassion on others and you know, from other countries and things like that. But these kids are kind of smart, then. If they, you know, we were saying they're turning themselves over because they're under duress or something like that. You know, it could, in one sense, it could be organized. And then in the other sense, me, I'm waiting for a visa now, right? I got enough money to take care of myself to live in the United States, but I'm on a lottery. I'm waiting for a visa to come to the United States. So what's to say that I have enough money to live here? What's to say I can tell my kids, okay, go, you know, I'm going to take my kids to Mexico or someplace and say, okay, go into the United States and say you're under duress? I mean, is that fair for people who are waiting legitimately to come to New York City to live, to open a business, or to establish a life? Is it fair for them who are waiting on a lottery or waiting to pay for their visas that we let people come in free?
Commissioner?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I actually think, again, this is a question of what we obviously need at the federal level is federal immigration reform, which would address this backlog issue, which I totally agree is a problem. When we talk about getting to the back of the line, if the line is so long that the wait is interminable, that is a problem for folks that are already here. And I think part of the reason why we see such an influx of undocumented people trying to come into the United States is because we haven't reformed our immigration system so far. So, again, I would think we need to fix the system for people like you while at the same time showing compassion for these refugee children.
Ignatius in Woodside, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ignatius.
Hi, good morning. I would like to ask you, is there any way that these kids could be hosted by a host family?
That's a good question. I mean, so far, I think the only discussion has been around the shelters and the there are strict federal guidelines about what the shelters could be. And so I don't know that it would be possible to have host families support these children. But there will be and could be other ways that individuals who want to help can assist these children. And we're exploring those and figuring out ways for the public to be involved.
Like how?
You know, I imagine, I know in some of the Texas detention centers / shelters where these children are, they've asked for clothing and other kinds of sort of resources for the children. We haven't started mobilizing any of that in New York City, but to the extent that, those are the types of ways in which people can help out, that would be great.
And the host families question, probably not so relevant to this situation because you said the criteria for placing kids here in the first place tends to be that they have relatives.
Exactly.
Anna in Briarcliff Manor, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anna.
I just think this is so utterly ridiculous. It makes Americans look very foolish. We can't control kids coming across the border. And with the reasoning that this woman is talking about, there are kids in all parts of Africa who are trying to escape gang violence. Should we bring them all here? And to release 14 to 17-year-old boys into this country from a violent country, they have no education, no jobs, no money. What else do you think they're going to do in this country? It just is so ridiculous.
Commissioner, talk to Anna.
Sure. So, you know, I think that the point of being able to provide some of the services and supports to these kids is so that they're not just left to, you know, be in New York City without educational services, connections to the services that would prevent them from really going down the wrong path. And so I think that's the idea here. And, you know, I think
we don't even have money for kids in our own country who are going down the wrong path. And we're borrowing this money. Taxpayers will have to pay for this. It's just insulting. It's very extremely insulting. And for anyone to vote for Democrats, they do not care about the taxpayers. It's just horrible.
Well, we got into a blanket partisan statement there. But many Americans obviously feel the way she feels on the issue. How many refugees can the United States take in? And if we're setting a single standard here of children fleeing violence, why not the children from Central Africa, the example she used, who are probably in need of refugee status in much greater numbers?
Right. I mean, I think one of the reasons that we're seeing children that are coming from Central America is because that they are sort of proximate to us, and that's how they're getting here. You know, we also do have a well-functioning refugee system that also does enable people from other parts of the world that are fleeing persecution or other problems to come into the United States and to be integrated here, and we have that system in place as well. Again, it's a system that enables the country to be able to assist those who are in need, but also ensures that it's done in a way that's planned and thoughtful.
I think Catherine in Manhattan wants to talk back to Anna in Briarcliff. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Brian. So I spent a few months in El Salvador a couple of years ago, and so I follow what's going on down there. And I just don't think people understand what these kids live through down there. First of all, the notion that the kids who come here are the ones who want to be criminals and gangsters. If they wanted to be criminals and gangsters, they would stay in El Salvador. That's how a kid survived down there. What happened a couple of years ago was a report came out, I believe it was the State Department came out with a report that El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala had the highest murder rate in the world. And the government of El Salvador decided that the way to bring down the murder rate was to create a truce between the gangs. And it was I walked around as an American citizen fearlessly in El Salvador. All the murders that happened down there are between gang violence against each other. So the government decided to create a truce between gangs, which actually had the result of unifying and empowering the whole gang culture in El Salvador. That happened a couple years ago, and that's probably what the big shift was that has created it. The gangs run the school. A good kid who wants to go to school and stay out of trouble does not have an option to do that. I mean, the kids who are fleeing here are the ones who want to live a decent life, who want to be good kids, who don't want to be involved in violence. And it's extraordinary. The number of people, one of the major ways the gangs make money is that they go to random people, and they threaten them. They say, if you do not give us $2,000, we will kill your mother, your family. And people live under this sort of violence constantly. They have to move. They have to hide. I had a friend down there whose boyfriend was a U.S. citizen, and she had two children by him who were in the U.S., and she could not get permission. She waited years trying to get permission to come to the United States. So the idea that there is a line to get in, especially these kids, these people have no money. You have to apply. You have to pay just to apply to the United States.
Catherine, I'm going to leave it there. We have a terrible phone connection, but we hear a lot of what you're saying about the situation in El Salvador. We're almost out of time, but I'm comparing the last two callers, one who's afraid that a lot of these kids without education grew up in violent societies are going to be more prone to violence and go down the wrong path if they're allowed to stay here, than the second caller who said, well, no, these are the good kids. These are the ones who are fleeing the violence. I don't want to whitewash or vilify these kids as a group. What if somebody does commit a crime when they're here in this status? Does that change their ability to stay? Does that change their application for asylum?
I think that immigration law has a certain bars and restrictions and rules around criminal activity, and it significantly influences your ability to stay in the country. So, of course.
Before you go, will the kids be eligible for the municipal ID cards that the mayor and city council have approved to begin issuing next year?
You know, if the children end up being residents of New York City and can establish their identity and residency, then yes, they could get a municipal ID card.
And can you say something about the implementation of the municipal IDs from an immigrant affairs standpoint? Are they mostly to make it easier for undocumented immigrants to get government services?
No, actually, we really do see this as an ID card for all New Yorkers, many of whom are non-immigrants. They may be people who are seniors or homeless who have difficulty getting ID, though, of course, also a major group that will benefit from this are undocumented immigrants.
New York City Immigration Affairs Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, running a task force now set up by Mayor de Blasio to help the unaccompanied child migrants from Central America coming into New York by the thousands. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. All right, a little bit of the song Meet Me in the Bathroom by The Strokes, because right now we will talk about bathrooms. You use them several times a day, no doubt, but do you ever think about how they're designed or what effect they have on the environment? We have someone joining us right now who has been thinking about bathrooms. Lloyd Alter is managing editor of Tree Hugger. If you are something, why not call yourself that? Very plain and simple. And he wrote an article for The Guardian arguing for a redesign of Western bathrooms. The piece is called Why the Modern Bathroom is a Wasteful, Unhealthy Design. Lloyd, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
You argue that bathrooms are based on the plumbing system, not human needs. Want to explain that?
Absolutely. The way the bathroom really evolved in North America is that water supplies were brought into houses first to stop disease that was coming from drinking contaminated water. And once people had water, they started using it for everything, and their consumption went way up. And one of the things that quickly became popular that no one expected was that they would stop using outhouses and they started putting in toilets. And the whole American system was developed on it all just being shipped off to rivers, because most American cities and towns were built on rivers. That was a primary way of communication. And so they thought, oh, well, we'll just take all this water, increasing quantities of dirty water because everything was combined, and just dump it in the rivers. And so by the turn of the 20th century, there was already huge pollution problems happening everywhere from so much waste being generated. And it was all really accidental. Some engineers were saying, no, we should be doing sewage farming, taking it off and spreading it in fields and using the fertilizer. But the attitude at the time was the solution to pollution is dilution. Just put it in the rivers.
So, listeners, do you have any ideas for how to improve our bathrooms? 212-433-WNYC. Have you had a bathroom experience maybe in another country that was either eye-opening for one reason or another, or instructive for one reason or another? Any funny bathroom stories out there that have to do with how they're designed? 212-433-WNYC. We know how people use the radio. Maybe you're listening to our show in the bathroom right now. Call us from your bathroom phone, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take a call from Aaron in Brooklyn. Hi, Aaron. You're on WNYC. Aaron?
Good morning, Brian. I'm with Green Mountain Construction, and I specialize in renovating bathrooms. And I'm called quite often by people that have moldy shower stalls and tiles falling out of their tub surrounds. But I never find that these areas are waterproof. And as a result, people keep renovating the same place over and over again. When it looks bad or when they transfer the apartment to somebody else, they make the same mistake. They don't waterproof the wet areas. And as a result, I keep carting off perfectly good materials off to the dump from places that were renovated recently.
So that's...
I think that that's the most wasteful thing. It's not only water. It's the whole thing. It's the whole bathroom gets renovated because somebody, you know, it was too cheap to put in a waterproof layer where they needed it.
Aaron, thank you very much. Good tip. Now, in your article, you suggest a few different types of futuristic toilets that could help save water. Composting toilets, vacuum toilets, foam flush toilets. You want to tell us about one of these?
Well, all of these, the problem is that when the water that comes out of your sink, out of your laundry, most of the uses of water that we have produce what's called gray water. It's contaminated. You're not going to drink it, but you can use it in your garden. There's a lot of functions that it can be put to. What comes out of your toilet is called black water, and it's a problem. And so the real ambition, if we're going to build plumbing systems that work, is that we've got to separate the toilet water from everything else. And so that means you can't just use tap water, purified tap water, to flush. So the foam toilets, the composting toilets, and the vacuum toilets are all different ways of eliminating the use of drinking water to flush our toilets. And none of them are quite as pleasant as the toilets we've got now, unfortunately.
Well, that's a big problem, isn't it? People will be resistant to unpleasantness, and maybe you should describe what kind of unpleasantness you're proposing people put up with.
Well, the vacuum toilets are the least unpleasant of them all because it just air pressure just sucks it away. I have to be careful and think of the seven words George Carlin said you could never use on radio and be careful not to use any of them here.
One of them is dysentery. Anyway, go ahead.
But anyhow, the vacuum system is great. The composting systems are getting better all of the time. There are some that you do not feel that you're sitting on top of a pile of whatever, but it actually is quite a distance away, and they are being used more and more commonly. In high-rise buildings in New York City, you could easily develop a community composting toilet system in a building where it all goes down to the basement and is processed there. In Europe, they do it where all that stuff goes in, and then it is cooked anaerobically, and they get methane out of it that they heat their apartments with.
James in Greenpoint, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually calling from my own bathroom this morning, and I just had to call because I think we take for granted modern bathrooms, even in New York City, as small as they may be. I spent 2 years after the earthquake in Haiti working on sanitation solutions and building compostable toilets for the citizens of Haiti. And to them, even a compost toilet, something as simple as a few boards put together with hammers and nails, was such a commodity for them, and they were so appreciative. I think it's important for us to realize clean water and a warm, comfortable seat to sit on for our 30 seconds to 1 minute of time by ourselves. I think that's important for us to realize how lucky we really are.
James, thank you very much. Maybe we could have Haiti-style bathrooms in the affordable apartments in the mixed build. Oh, never mind. That's from our last segment. Suresh in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am from India, and what we have there is in the flush. That's a lever on the flush, and whenever we press it down, it flushes the toilet. And the minute we press it up, we pull it up, the water stops. And also some of the flushes have half flush options for half flush and full flush. So that way we save the water we use for flushing the toilets. Whereas here, when I press the lever, all the whole tank empties out.
Interesting. Lloyd Alter from Tree Hugger, is that something you're familiar with?
I'm sorry, I had a computer problem and I missed the question.
Oh, he was talking about hot flush and cold flush in the toilets in India.
No, I was talking about the half and full.
Half and full flush. Yes, this is very common on toilets that you can buy now at any plumbing supply store. All of my toilets have exactly that. They have a button for a full flush, and they have another half of the button for a partial flush, because when you urinate, you don't need nearly as much water to flush it down.
And I know that when I was in California during the drought, and I was visiting somebody in their home, they were saying, well, we have a saying out here,
If it's yellow, let it mellow.
If it's brown, flush it down. So this is kind of a halfway measure. I see a lot of toilets already that are flush toilets, but they seem to use much less water. Like, you don't see the old style thing where water kind of swirls around and piles up first, and then it goes down. There's not that much water in it, and it goes right down.
Yes, well, this is a rule set by the government a few years ago that implemented lower amounts of water in the flush toilets. And when they first came out, they were not very good, and people complained and were running to Canada to buy toilets and smuggle them back across the border. And I believe a Republican senator in Arizona, of all places, just put forward a Republican congressman put forward a resolution to stop the EPA from promoting low flush toilets because he says they don't work. And it's a crock. They work perfectly. You wouldn't even know you were on one nowadays. They've gotten good enough that they really are as good as the old toilets.
What's the underlying issue here? Is it a water shortage?
It's a water shortage and the cost of processing the waste. The water shortage is an obvious one. They use a lot of water, but more importantly, they contaminate the output to such a degree that it's extremely expensive and power-absorbing to purify the water. In certain parts of California, they're now recycling toilet water and all the water, pumping it back into the ground, and you're actually drinking it. And this is a ridiculously expensive process.
Doesn't the waste wind up in waste treatment plants along the river anyway, no matter how much water we use to get it there?
Well, yes, it is expensively removed, and it is often used as the sludge is often tried. They try to use it for agricultural purposes and on farms. And unfortunately, because of our antibiotics and because of our birth control pills and the other things that go into them, it's still pretty toxic stuff.
Sam in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sam.
Well, I just had a nice little chuckle with your guest mentioning spending 30 seconds to 1 minute on the toilet. He must have a very high fiber diet if he's spending so little time on the toilet. But I actually called to express my gratitude about the flush toilet because I grew up in upstate New York with an outhouse my entire childhood. And, there's nothing like sliding down a hill, grabbing a tree to get into the outhouse in the middle of winter. And, you put a little lime powder over the over whatever you left behind, and that's your way of bringing it back to balancing the E. coli there. But I'll tell you something. I don't think New Yorkers appreciate the flush toilet enough. It's I live in gratitude every time I flush the toilet in my older adult life because it's a wonderful thing, the flush toilet. People just need to go to Turkey where you can relieve yourself in a hole in the ground in a building, which is incredibly unpleasant.
Right. I've experienced that in a number of countries, and you're not proposing that we go all the way there, right?
Well, actually, squat toilets are far healthier for your body. You may think that, oh my God, I'm squatting down over a hole, but that's the way our bodies were designed. And there are a lot of people who say that the fact that we're sitting on toilets causes constipation, causes hemorrhoids, causes all kinds of internal problems, because that's not how we're built. So, in fact, I think we'd be a lot better off if we were using a Chinese-style squat over a hole flush toilet.
You are going all the way there.
Yes.
Felix in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
So, hey, how you doing? So, speaking of other countries and their toilets, so in England and France, they have a separate, just a room with a toilet, and then next to it, there's the bathtub and the sink and stuff. And I was wondering what the origin of that is, if anyone knows.
It's interesting. The origin of that is in Britain. When they first got plumbing, everybody had washstands in their bedrooms with a bucket and a pail, and they washed there with a pitcher. So when they first got water, the first thing they did was just put sinks in their washstands, and then they had to put the toilet somewhere, so they would stick it under the stairs in a closet, hence the water closet. Then in 1906, the Statler Hotel opened in Buffalo, and it was the first hotel in the world that had a bathroom in every room. And it had everything lined up in a row, really efficiently, really tightly, all in one room. And the plumbers saw that and said, wow, we can do that, and it's cheap and it's efficient. And every bathroom built in America ever since has been a model after the Statler in Buffalo. In fact, it's a really terrible idea to have the toilet in the same room as the sink. When you flush a toilet, the E. coli vaporizes and can go up to 20 feet away from the toilet. So if anything else, you should absolutely always close the lid of the toilet. The European model of the toilet in a separate room, which you also find in almost every high-end hotel now, is far healthier and far better, and I'm building it right now in my own house.
We just have 2 minutes left, and I want to acknowledge that we've been talking mostly about toilets, but you also argue in your piece that our showers are poorly designed. What's important to say about that?
Well, our showers are terribly designed if they only have a shower head up on the wall falling on your head, because you've got to be able to wash all of yourself. And frankly, the dirty bits are often needing a shower head pointing up. The other thing is they're death traps. One American dies every day by falling in the shower, because they all should have hand grips. They should all have thermostatically controlled, and they shouldn't be in bathtubs where you're stepping over the edge onto a slippery bottom. It's designed to kill, really.
Now, here's how YouTube user Teacher Tack describes taking his first Japanese bath.
The first time that I took a bath in Japan, my grandma got pretty upset at me because I cleaned myself and I drained all of the water inside of the bathtub. And she said, it's such a waste and everything. And I thought, well, it's dirty water. Like, why would anyone want to use it? But I didn't realize that this is the place to clean yourself. And that's the place to just relax.
This is the place to clean yourself. And that's the place to relax. Meaning that was about the length of the shower?
Well, no. In Japan, you would sit on a stool. You have a tap that you turn on and off, so you only use the water when you need it. And you get yourself totally clean, and then you go and relax in the tub. That's the purpose of it. But you do your washing in the shower, which is a separate place.
So how much are your ideas spreading? How much have people already started to build bath? New style bathrooms? Are eco-friendly bathrooms in vogue in new construction to any meaningful degree?
You're seeing more and more people are putting the toilet in a separate room, which is a really good thing. But you're still seeing bathtubs entirely designed for looks instead of comfort. You're still seeing showers where the controls are right underneath the shower head, so you're scalding yourself when you turn the stuff on. Shiny tiles on the floor, marble bathrooms. Marble is so slippery when it's wet, it's insane.
So and yet still
Touch.
A set of hardly touched ideas in this country. Lloyd Alter is managing editor of Tree Hugger. He wrote the Guardian article, Why the Modern Bathroom is a Wasteful, Unhealthy Design. Thanks so much for coming on.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.